Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Valley Roundup. This week, a special Aspen Ideas Festival episode. Joining me today here in the studio are Dan Porterfield, President and CEO of the Aspen Institute. Dan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Allison.
I also have Jillian Tett. She's the U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times and a columnist there. Jillian, thank you so much for your time.
Great to be here. I'm going to bring the British accent.
As radio needs. And Jonathan Capehart, an opinion writer for the Washington Post and the host of Cape Up Podcast. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, Allison.
Thank you all for joining me. This is Valley Roundup from Aspen Public Radio. Let's get right into it. So one of the things the Aspen Ideas Festival is praised for is this access to newsmakers, essentially, that attendees, journalists, anyone can be sitting at lunch right next to national policymakers. Dan, I want to get your take on the feel of the festival. What is that kind of mixing and mingling like over on campus?
The feel is just very special because you have great dialogues being moderated often by some of the best journalists in the country or in the world, like Jillian and Jonathan. And then you have commentators, experts, government officials, students, activists, writers, poets, musicians, a little bit of everything for dialogue that's about identifying the leading edge of issues, so that we can then break out from the tents and go around and sit around at coffee tables and talk to one another about what we just heard and learned.
And Jonathan and Jillian, as journalists then, what is that like to be able to find someone on that level? We're in paradise here in Aspen and you're having coffee, but you still are able to have access to the people you would interview for your respective papers.
Well, I would say it's not so much for the journalists the ability to have access to newsmakers here that's important, although that obviously matters. What's really important is that at Aspen you can collide with the unexpected. Mm-hmm. The last book I wrote was called The Silo Effect, and it argued that the real peril of the modern world is we're all trapped in these professional silos, geographical silos, political silos, and we just don't bump into people outside our tribe. And yes, Aspen in some ways is the elite in a tribalized way, and yet we have people from all different areas of life bumping into each other and having time to collide, time to roam intellectually, and that is so powerful.
Jillian hits the nail on the head here, being able to collide with the unexpected. But to jump off something that Dan just said, it's those moments outside the formal sessions that really make Aspen Ideas Festival special. You can sit in the audience and watch a briefing or a moderated discussion, and then when it's over, you can walk right up to the stage, try to talk to the person who was there, get your question answered that you weren't able to ask, or talk to other people and, oh, what did you think about what that person said? And I'd never thought about that. And what does that mean? I'm going to take that idea and I'm going to run with it, how, in whatever manner that means. That's what makes Aspen Ideas so special. I think for journalists like Jillian and myself, a lot of the people here, you know, there are a phone call or an email away. That's not what makes this special, because we do have some access to these folks. It's the idea that we are all here on this very small piece of paradise, and we can sit and talk in a casual manner that leads to something, a piece, an interview, a story, an idea. That leads to something big. For Jillian, it was a book, The Silo Effect.
Dan, it sounds like you were on a panel called Where Do Ideas Come From? This kind of launch off to the festival. It sounds like what we're hearing in this room is spontaneity and the right collision, the right mixes as part of where that the new idea can happen.
Absolutely. And one thing that we do to help enable that is we provide about 300 scholarships to young people from all over the place to come and join the conversation. For example, there are 20 young people in their mid-20s who are all graduates of KIPP public charter schools around the country. They're all here mashing it up with our speakers and other attendees. I just on the way over here sat with three women who are leaders in Native American communities doing incredible work to organize communities and to tell the story of tribal communities and culture. They're brought here on scholarship. And then just before that, I ran into a young man I formerly taught who's working in Latino communities in Chicago to empower college access. And so I really like that part of it, that we're making sure that The conversations are as inclusive as can be. I think in the future you'll see still more scholarships for still more people, including, of course, people of all ages from Aspen, Colorado, and surrounding communities.
The word that came to mind as Dan was speaking was disruption.
Okay.
A lot of times people probably have the view that, oh, it's that elite cadre of people who go to Aspen and they talk amongst themselves. And especially with this Ideas Festival, it's all been about disruption and making people feel uncomfortable. I mean, that's where the big ideas come from. That's where the big insight comes from, when your notion of what the world is completely rocked. And you can only get that when you have people who otherwise wouldn't be here or who otherwise haven't been invited, who can come in and who are of the caliber and who should be here, be able to say, you know what you just said, that's not my research, that's not my lived experience, that's not correct. And to be able to have that conversation in a civil, respectful manner is the other key.
I mean, one other thing I'd say, it's one of the strengths of Aspen in the past, even without looking at the bigger issues of inclusivity, which I know Dan's working on, but is the fact, because Aspen is in the geographical center, the middle of America, you've always had the East Coast meet the West Coast, meet the South here, which is powerful. It brings along both the tech sector, the banking sector, the energy sector, and the different parts of academia in Aspen. The other aspect, of course, is that, you know, you've often had, in some ways, a liberal bias amongst the attendees in the Aspen Ideas Festival. But what I've noticed in the last couple of years is there have been some very fiery debates between Republicans and Democrats, people really trying to redefine what political tribalism is about here. And so, again, that's part of the collision point and the crossroads point that Aspen can be at its best.
Were there moments like that this year?
Yesterday, we held an afternoon of conversation in which we're able to enjoy performances from this great group of actors and actresses.
It was superb.
You know, that just rocked the sort of the house of moments, key moments from all these different important plays. You know, A Raisin in the Sun was one of them. And then we had cultural commentators like Jonathan, David Brooks, Jelani Cobb, and others reflecting on the meanings or interpretations of those scenes. But there was a moment at the end when one of the actors performed the song My Shot from Hamilton. And Maria Hinojosa was on the panel. And so the interviewer asked, you know, what do you think about that? And she said, well, you know, I can't help but think that song, My Shot, I'm not going to throw away my shot, is all about the lives of the people on the border of America right now whose children are being separated from them. Those parents will do anything to protect their children, give them their shot. They'll walk up from Mexico. They'll ride on the roof of a train. They'll say goodbye to families and communities they love to take their shot. And it was silent in the crowd. A couple hands clapped. Maria got us to reinterpret what we had just listened to. And that was disruptive, productively so.
Right.
Disruptive.
And when no one clapped, Maria said, oh, great, what one person clapped. And then she explained why she said what she said. And then people are like, the light bulbs go off on their heads. And like, oh, that's what she means. And then there is greater applause. But that's the beauty of Aspen. Just like take people by the lapels and say, listen, there's a bigger meaning than what you've already put on this particular thing.
I really like that specific example you gave. Are there other moments where you came to learn something or you came thinking that you would hear, you knew what you were going to hear and you learned something? You can go describe it to the next person.
Well, for me, there's been many, many. One that I especially enjoyed was the economist Raj Chetty, who has done incredibly rich work using big data sets of census information and tax information, anonymized, so no one's personal information is used, to understand critical factors like economic mobility or the lack of mobility all across the country. But what he's been able to do since I saw him last was start to develop micro data that shows the impact of a particular zip code. You know, who born between 1978 and 1983 at this zip code is then doing what? What's the average income of those people? Or how many are in prison?
Whoa.
An incredible, mind-blowing use of big data. It's a lot more to think about still. But I think this is, you know, the kind of introduction to a big emerging new idea you get at Aspen that then changes your own work later when you leave. You think, I have to learn more about this. I've got to get more informed.
I mean, I can jump in and say I had a breakfast this morning with Southern Electricity and a whole bunch of different people involved in the digital world to talk about privacy and identity and cyber hacking and digital development. And it was absolutely explosive because, you know, I sort of, for my part, I'm trained as a cultural anthropologist and I've looked a lot at the blend of social science and big data. And, you know, I wanted to try and talk about the idea of what's going on in the digital economy being about the barter economy, not the normal economy we think of in terms of economics. And we had an absolutely explosive debate about the question of, you know, what are consumers trading with tech companies today? What are companies trading with tech companies in B2B space? And how should we reframe the debate to recognize that at the moment, both sides are getting value, but they also feel they're losing value. How do we create a more sustainable, fair digital economy? And the privacy of these conversations and the range of people collected over breakfast means you really get an honest debate where people say, we don't know the answers yet. We need to talk as a group and learn from each other.
It's a lot like the session that you are on, how is new power shaping our world, and a peer-driven economy. Like, what are the new economies going to be? In your work as a reporter, are you an expert in that? What are you, like, do you feel like you know where it's going, or are there a lot of questions left to ask?
Well, I'm fundamentally deeply conflicted, somewhat bipolar or schizophrenic in the way I think intellectually, because I'm both a reporter, I'm both in charge of our editorial content for the Financial Times in America, but I'm also, say, an anthropologist trained to deconstruct the system of information that we live in. So I spend half the time sort of trying to criticize myself. But the key point is this, that we have this huge paradox today. Trust in institutions has collapsed, and yet the digital economy only operates because we trust in horizontal relationships. We trust in our peer group via social media and digital data. And that's creating big challenges for journalists, because a world where people trust their Facebook friends and Twitter for information rather than the wise words of an editorial from the Financial Times or Washington Post is a very different world for us to live in. And I think we're all groping towards solutions. Jonathan, you provide some answers here.
Answers.
Well, I want to concentrate completely on that panel that you did last night about trust in journalism. We're going to take a quick break and come right back to that. Thank you. You are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm joined by Dan Porterfield, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, Jillian Tett, the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times, and Jonathan Capehart, an opinion writer for the Washington Post. Thanks for tuning in. So, Jonathan, you were on this panel this week called How We Survive Attacks on Journalism, and I'm really, really interested to hear how the group in this room feels about that. Give us a summary of how that talk went. What were some of the big themes that came up?
Well, this is a huge issue, and we do not have nearly enough time for me to even summarize what we talked about. One is the issue of just trust in media, how much people just don't trust the media anymore. We talked about how attacks by the president of the United States calling us enemies of the people, and not only attacking journalism institutions, but attacking individual reporters by name. What kind of an impact that has. We talked about how having a White House press secretary lie to the press every day, what that does to not only how journalists do their jobs, but also how that helps erode the trust in the institution of the press. People forget that there is only one profession that is specifically called out and protected in the Constitution of the United States, and that is journalism. And so the fact that we are being attacked by the number one person who is sworn to uphold and protect the Constitution, that's a big deal. One thing that I went off on a tear about is that, you know, we have responsibilities as journalists. We are, you know, famously, we write the first draft of history. We get things wrong. We correct them if we are ethical and honorable and moral. And we move on and try to be as accurate as possible as we go along. But in this digital age, when everyone has the same access to information as everyone else, it's not no longer the time when we as journalists had proprietary ownership of all information, and then we meted it out to folks as we figured they needed it. Now, everyone gets their news from everywhere. So that to me means that the news consumer, the radio listener, the television viewer, the streaming viewer, the person who's reading blogs and Facebook and things like that, they have as much a responsibility as we do as journalists to make sure that the information that they are getting is as accurate as possible, but also as varied as possible. To Jillian's a book, The Silo Effect, how we're all in these silos. The internet has actually made that, has exacerbated that problem, because now we only go to those news sources that that validate our worldview. We're no longer able to collide with that story that might challenge our assumptions or present to us something we didn't even know about. And so I always encourage news consumers, if you're watching MSNBC or CNN, take an hour or however much you can bear and watch Fox News. Read the Weekly Standard. Read the National Review. Get a different point of view, if only so that you can come up with you know what the other side is saying and come up with arguments to knock down what your uncle at Thanksgiving might want to say to argue with you. But I think that makes for better news consumers, but it also makes for better citizens.
Dan, what have some of the sessions made you start thinking about journalism in our current age?
One of the big ones is a group of journalists, including Katie Couric, who are going to talk about the next phase of the Me Too movement. I think that's been a theme that's run across a lot of our programming, is how our sort of like the greater public awareness, or maybe coming to light of things we sort of knew but didn't call out enough in terms of discrimination, harassment, other forms of essentially, I guess I'll say just uncivil and inappropriate identity-based power expression playing out across corporations and journalism and higher education and other parts of our society. Those are conversations that have really rocked the nation. And I'm this is very important to hear journalists like Katie Couric talking from experience and then looking forward about what we can do to make sure that the seeming progress we're starting to make, and not just on gender issues, but all issues of identity, that we sustain. It's not easy in a world where, sort of tribalism and the silo effect seems to keep us apart from one another, but we have to knock down those walls and listen to each other's experiences so we can create common ground and common purpose together.
You have this academic background, and you're on several panels that have to do with life on campus, because those are their own kind of little bubbles, right? Within our nation as a whole. One of them is about free speech and campus. Can you talk about how that ties into social media now and journalism now and who gets to speak at a university?
Yeah, these are, as Jonathan said about his, these are deep issues which run in lots of directions. But I want to say something that's perhaps a little counterintuitive, because we've all been reading stories about the latest outrage at this campus or that campus. And I actually think there is a vast number of young people that are trying to foster dialogue and are not racing to label each other and shut each other down on our campuses. And to give one example, at Franklin and Marshall College, where I was president, last year or 2 years ago, a group of students, and we know there were students, posted on a social media platform anonymous racist messages. We knew it came from the campus. The African-American students on campus organized a protest. What they did was they took screenshots of the offensive graffiti before they hit the sort of button that made it go away. Then they blew up those screenshots and posted them in a giant board on campus so that everybody could walk by in the student center and see what was written by students on Yik Yak. And then a student named J.L. Lewis led the whole effort, had a second part of this display that was blank wall, where we could write our own messages of response to what we had read other students had wrote. And then a whole lot of us, including lots of faculty, wrote messages of solidarity and hope. And so what these students had done, our Black Student Union, was created a pro-speech protest. Nobody wants to cover a pro-speech protest. They only want to say students are shouting each other down and yelling at each other. But I saw the opposite all the time on campus.
Well, that's a fascinating story. And I want to pick up on something Jonathan said about the fact the media lives in an age of attack. Because in some ways, the fact that the president has made direct attacks on the media is the easy part to talk about. To my mind, that's not the D we should look at. We should look at four or five other Ds. The fact we live in an age of disintermediation, where essentially new technological platforms are allowing the president to disintermediate the media. We live in an age of constant distraction. Mm. And I often joke that the president's approach towards media is a bit like an Agatha Christie novel. There's a commotion in the library, there's probably a body in the kitchen.
Yes.
And there's a constant sense of distraction, distracting around from the key issues. We live in an age of disruption, and we also live in an age of discrediting and destabilization. And in that age, it's so easy to be tempted to just talk about what's top of the news on the cable shows, mm-hmm. what the easy issue is that's going to provoke outrage and anger and response, like, as we've just heard, some of the racist comments on campus. Trying to shift the debate to talk about the long-term policy issues, trying to listen to the silent majority who are not wanting to foster hate, but actually some kind of inclusive dialogue, trying to actually look at the underlying structural themes is very hard in this era. But that's what we need to be doing as journalists. And insofar as the Aspen Institute is trying to do that, I salute it and hope we can build on that.
Jonathan, I want to ask you two things that Jillian has brought up, maybe to close out. One is this conflict between columnist and editor and journalist, because you're a columnist, right? So how do you balance out that opinion? And you brought up something in the panel where it's like, I have to point that out. Should we make the pages a different color? You know, like, this is a different type right. of than a news story. But let's pair that with, maybe we don't always talk about the bad.
Well, look, one thing a lot of people don't understand, columnists and opinion writers are journalists. It's not that we like get up one morning and then start, you know, spouting off with no background, no reporting, no nothing. I can only speak for myself. And I've only worked for reporting editorial boards, and every column I do is reported. So I do my own reporting. The only difference and the big difference between what Jillian does and what I do is that I actually get to say, I have the privilege of being able to say, having talked to both sides, looked at both sides, I think this side is right. Or I think this side is wrong, or both sides need to do a better job. Look, I think since the beginning of journalism, the reader, the news consumer has not been able to tell the difference between a news story and an opinion piece. Even though opinions are at the back of the paper, even though the editorials have no names on them, folks don't quite understand what that is. Papers try to do a good job of saying this is analysis, or this is however they want to describe it. One person on the panel the other night said, well, maybe we need to do a better job of, maybe they need to be in different colors, and maybe it's got to be a big banner. And I'm sitting here thinking, how much hand-holding of the public must we do before we just say, you know what, you have a responsibility, news consumer. You have a responsibility. I've done all the work. It's like I went on a tear the other night about how with my report, I've reported. As I write, I have in my head, someone's going to say, how do you know that?
Okay.
And so for how do you know that, I put in a hyperlink. Because I respect the reader enough to know that if they ask that, they want an answer, here's the answer. What I can't control is the person not clicking on that link. How many times have I had someone yell at me, why didn't you say this? Well, actually, I did. Here's the screenshot of the paragraph that you didn't even bother to read. I've gone down a whole different path. But so that's the difference between the news side and the opinion side. And I really don't think that there are so many guardrails and everything you can put up, but cars still crash through the guardrail.
Jillian, what's the balance between responsibility of the reporter to cover all the stories, not just the horrifying stories, and then the responsibility of the consumer to be able to weed out what's news, what's not?
Well, at the end of the day, we are frankly in a consumer-facing business, the media, and we should get real and recognize that we are providing a product that consumers want. We happen to think at the FT that we serve our consumers best by not just giving them what they think they want to know, what mm-hmm. they think they think, but trying to allow them to collide with the unexpected in other ways too. So we try and both present them with information and try and challenge them as well. But the reality is that plenty of consumers of media today in America don't want to do that. That just is a business reality. At the end of the day, though, I just make two points. One is, it is beholden on the media today to be humble and to recognize that the liberal intelligentsia, intellectuals, academics, policymakers, journalists, basically have an epistemological framework based on rational Enlightenment thought, which to us appears self-evidently correct, But actually, there are many other epistemological frameworks of thought out there in America today which are different. And as an anthropologist, I would argue very strongly we have to recognize that ours is not the only way of thinking, and even though we think it's correct, that's not how everyone else thinks, and we have to basically take off our biases and listen humbly. Secondly, we need to recognize that we don't always get the truth. I often say to the reporters, on a good day, our stories get 30% of the truth because guess what? Life is complicated. I happen to think our rivals often get 20%, and that keeps me going. The Washington Post gets 29%.
29.999999999.
But we have to be humble and recognize that we need to learn and listen. And last but not least, we have to recognize that what Dan's doing to try and break down some of the elite silos is incredibly important. Aspen has traditionally been elitist. Let's accept that. It needs to stop being if it's going to carry on enabling us to collide with the unexpected. But doing that is very tough, and no one should mask over that problem.
I thank you so much for those comments. There's so much integrity in the way that the two of you approach your role. To say about Aspen, we all know that we're set in this beautiful part of the country, and we're hopefully getting out and taking some walks and eating good food and having good conversation, and we can kind of all hold hands for a moment and say, you know, mind, body, spirit, isn't that a unifying theme of the Aspen Ideas Festival? And yes, it is, but that's not complete. And I would say mind, body, spirit, citizen. We are all each other's partners in citizenship, whether we know each other and live near each other or in relation that's separated by oceans. We are all each other's citizen. When we come together in this place, I hope we leave energized to rebuild the bonds of common understanding and citizenship in our home communities around this country and around the world, because we have to do that to achieve our full potential as human beings.
I was going to say, I got a green card yesterday, which I'm over the moon about, and it's one step towards feeling more committed than ever to the intellectual life of America. There are so many things about America which are fantastic and which are a beacon for the rest of the world, and one of them is that at its best, America fosters intellectual collisions through citizenship and through an ability to actually work together to exchange ideas. Often doesn't work, particularly not in recent years, but that at least is the ideal that everyone should uphold, even with a strange British accent.
I am over the moon to have this cast here joining me on Valley Roundup this week. Dan Porterfield, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. Gillian Tett, she's the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times and a columnist. And Jonathan Capehart, an opinion writer for the Washington Post. He's the host of Cape Up Podcast. Thank you all for giving me your time.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
And congratulations, Dan, to your first Aspen Ideas Festival as president and CEO, and Gillian, the green card. That's huge. From climate change to feminism, Aspen Public Radio has your front row seat to the Aspen Ideas Festival from the Aspen Institute. Tune into our live broadcast from the conference June 21st through June 30th. The full schedule of our Aspen Ideas Festival coverage can be found online aspenpublicradio.org.